is known for having blank assay passwords or probe, going back to earlier versions. Unfortunately, the recent spiderworm, which went around exploiting SQL servers with a blank assay password, has put an end to that, hopefully. So we will not see this happening very often anymore. Extended sort procedures, they're famous for their buffer overflow vulnerabilities. I think there's at least 16 or 17 extended sort procedures that have buffer overflow issues in them. For those that don't know, an extended sort procedure is basically extra functionality, non-SQL functionality, that's exported by a DLL, and you would call this, you know, extra functionality by executing just like a normal stored procedure that contains a batch of SQL. Used to be issues with temporary stored procedures where, because it was temporary, no permissions checking was done. Consequently, someone could create a temporary stored procedure that called something like xp_cmd shell, and they would gain access to it when they would normally not have access to it. Obviously, sysadmins only have access to xp_cmd shell. Then, of course, there was another issue with open row set abuse. With open row set, you can run ad hoc queries and cause the server to loop back upon itself using a trusted connection, and consequently the SQL server would use its own credentials to log back into itself, and again one could upgrade privileges that way. So these are the traditional kind of vulnerabilities. Indeed, even today these things are being found, especially issues with extended stored procedures. In fact, a number of database vendors choose not to employ things like extended stored procedures simply because they are known to have loads of vulnerabilities in them. For example, Rubix from Rubix.com don't use stored procedures simply because of this issue. Rubix is designed specifically for trusted Solaris. If you're in a military system and you're protecting secret information, Rubix is worth a look at. Oracle, again, had problems with an unauthenticated system compromise with the stored procedure issue. Basically, when you create a library on an Oracle server, you essentially tell the listener to load this library, exec this function, and pass it these parameters. And unfortunately, an attacker could insert themselves in between that communications process and directly speak to the listener, as you know, without passing credentials, and say, "I am an Oracle process. Please launch this. Please load this library. Exec this function and pass it these parameters." So this kind of error in terms of database functionality definitely seems to be where most of the problems lie, the external stored procedure issues. So these specific traditional SQL Server attacks we've just been speaking about, Microsoft SQL attacks, that is, other than the blank passwords, most of these, in fact, all of these attacks require the user to be able to log in some form or fashion. So that requires a user ID and password. Now, obviously, where SQL injection comes into this, you have a web application that has a user ID and password defined for you. These attacks are going to be, you know, extremely relevant for you because the web application defines the user ID and password, and you're authenticated. So although I do say most of these attacks require a user ID and password, it's not uncommon for that to be provided for you anyway, especially with SQL injection. So they're still worth looking at. So are there ways to look at a SQL server without credentials in terms of, you know, compromising it? Well, at first I thought PWD Encrypt. Someone, I can't remember the name, Jimmers, I think, actually, the guy who was playing with SQL and encryption and decryption, found a buffer overflow in PWD Encrypt the other day. Microsoft released a patch for that about two to four weeks ago. Now, when an SQL login, i.e. not a Windows authenticated user, someone who has an SQL login defined for them, PWD Encrypt is used at the same time. Now, I took a quick look at it. I didn't look at it enough. This is why there's loads of question marks at the end of this. When you log in with a SQL login account, the PWD encryption function is used. So I was wondering if I could provide an overly long password, you know, in the ODBC connection, whether I could trigger this overflow in PWD Encrypt. I was not successful. That's not to say that it's not vulnerable, though. I just didn't look hard enough, perhaps. So that said, because there's a patch for it, this is going to be providing that the system's fully patched, if you're attempting to break into it, PWD encrypt is out the window. So that left me with a new thing to, had to look for a new way. Now, SQL Ping, a nifty little utility created by Chip Andrews of SQLsecurity.com. Chip's a great bloke, and he has a great site as well, SQLsecurity.com. If you are responsible for securing Microsoft SQL database services, bookmark this site, put it in one of your favorites kind of thing. It's definitely worth a read. Lots of good information there and a discussion board as well. So anyway, Chip Andrews released this tool called SQL Ping. And essentially, it is a name resolution tool. It will fire off a single UDP packet with a single byte UDP packet to UDP port 1434 on the SQL server. The single byte being a 02, and SQL Server will respond with information such as, actually, I've got it here. If you look on my right, I don't know if you can see it. Maybe I should increase the font. It replies with information such as the server name, the instance name, whether it's clustered, the version number, and everything like that. Incidentally, the version number being reported back is wrong. Version 8.00.194 is SQL Server with no service packs. But even when you apply service packs, SQL Ping, or rather SQL Server, will still reply with the version number of no service packs. So don't trust that information because it's incorrect. Now, in terms of named instances, this is something that was introduced with SQL Server 2000. You can have essentially multiple instances of SQL Server that use different named instances like foo and bar, and essentially you would use SQL name resolution to determine which one to connect to. So Query Analyzer or the Enterprise Manager would simply send a UDP packet 02 to the server and ask for this information such as, you know, what named instances do you have. Obviously, if you don't have any named instances other than the default, it's going to be MS SQL Server. Whether there are extra named instances or not, SQL Server will still reply with this information. So it's a bit of information leakage anyway. That in itself is not too much of a major problem. However, when I saw this tool and saw that it was sending only a single byte packet, 02, that's hex 02, by the way, the question that sprung to mind is, well, what do the others do? 00, 01, 03, all the way to FF. So I wrote a simple UDP scanner that, you know, went through from 0 to FF to find out if I could elicit a different response from the SQL Server, and by 8, SQL Server had died. Now, that immediately grabbed my attention, obviously. So what was going on? By looking at the assembly, you know, when I was debugging it, this is essentially what the code is doing at that point in an unpatched version, obviously. There is now a patch for these issues, by the way. I'll talk about that later. Essentially, someone's declaring, the code has declared a pointer to, a character pointer, you know, initialized it to null or whatever, and, you know, created an int variable as well, x. Unfortunately, what they do when SQL Server receives a packet with the first byte set to 08, it does some extra processing, and essentially what it does is calls struttoc. Now, struttoc looks for a specific token within a string. So, in this case, it's looking for a colon. Now, if there is no colon, if we just send a 08, a single byte packet, you know, with 08, when it looks at UDP input and performs struttoc, because there is no colon in our input, the pointer, the return from struttoc is null. There is no pointer to a colon in the string. So, unfortunately, what happened was the pointer is then passed to A2I without having been checked whether it's a valid pointer or not, and hence the process access violates and dies. Now, obviously, what they needed to do and have done in terms of the patch, in terms of this, is check whether, you know, struttoc returns a valid pointer. If it does, then continue processing. If not, error out. But, sorry? Well, it depends on the first byte, you see. 02 basically says, give me standard information back. 08 does a different action. We'll see that 04 does something else, and 0A, basically if I send a 0A to a SQL Server, it will reply back to me with a 0A, yeah? So there's a simple denial of service there, you know, network-based. I set my source port to 1434, spoof the IP address of another SQL Server, and then they start going like this to each other. It's really only interesting in terms of the fun factor, you know, seeing, you know, them pinging each other to death, essentially. It's definitely something that should be fixed, though, because obviously if you've got a number of SQL servers on your DMZ, you don't want them to start pinging each other, you know. Now, we'll talk about firewall stuff later on, but essentially, if let's say you have an externally hosted DNS server. If I spoof the IP address of your external DNS server, set the source port to 53, that will more than likely go through your firewall, yeah? And if you're using a non-RFC 1918 address, i.e. it's a rootable address, then, and I can find your SQL servers, these attacks will go through the firewall kind of thing, yeah? So, or alternatively, if you're using RFC 1918, well, won't go there. If I could also, you know, spoof the IP address of an internal address as well. So the firewall, some firewalls will, you know, think, well, this is, you know, got a clean, IP address, so just pass it through the firewall. Obviously, we'll talk about more about firewall issues later on and how to protect against these attacks and how you should set it up. So, but, yeah. I'm sorry?
I say you'd have to sort out that there were two SQL servers behind the firewall.
And you think that's a difficult proposition?
Huh?
And do you think that's a difficult proposition?
Could be.
Well, I think it's easy, personally.
Could be quite easy.
Well, when you're doing a penetration test, this is the kind of information that you need to gather to effectively succeed in your penetration test. Obviously, if the pen tester succeeds, it's bad for the company. Well, it's good in a way because they can start resolving these holes and stuff. But information gathering is one of the first things you'll do in a pen test, and that kind of information, you know, you should be able to get. And then there's always guesswork you can always rely on as well. You know, if you, for example, we know SQL Server is traditionally found with an IIS setup, and there are a number of ways to speak to an IIS machine to get its IP address back. You know. You know, so if they're using an RFC 1918 address and they're using 10.1.1.x, then we can start, you know, playing around with that. Unfortunately, these SQL UDP issues work over broadcast as well. So I don't even need to guess the specific IP address. I just go for the broadcast and I'll hit it, you know. So there are issues, you know. So, sorry, was that? All right, sorry. Okay. So, as I've already said, the problem with that bit of code, it wasn't checking the return value of Stratoc before it was passing it to A2i, hence the crash. So, when you look at it further, what that part of the code is actually looking for is, you know, when the first byte is set to 08, it expects a string, then a colon, then a number. Now, as it turns out, that's all about using the VIA. VIA, I'm not sure whether it's pronounced VIA or whether it's broken down into, you know, VIA or what. But essentially, this part of the functionality is to do with the VIA protocol. Now, unfortunately, if you put an extremely long string in here, you know, colon number, you know, to avoid the crash, there's a heap overflow, an exploitable heap overflow. The only thing with this one is you have to send three packets for the heap overflow to work. So that one's more of a headache to exploit. There's an easier one to exploit, so we'll look at that one. NTRegmon, a great tool from sysinternals.com, is one of, you know, the tools I frequently use in my toolkit. And when I found that crash and the heap overflow in the service, I went back to, you know, 0, 1, 3 and 4 and everything to see if I'd missed something. And indeed, when I sent 04, you know, I started putting on a string at the end. So I sent 04 AAAA and NTRegmon kicked in and showed me that there was a registry key attempting to be opened, HKLM, Software Microsoft, Microsoft SQL Server, AAAA, MS SQL Server current version. So here is user input that's being plugged into, you know, querying the registry. Now, in the process of building that registry key, you know, to do a reg query, there's a plain old classic Stack Overflow there. So that's the one we'll specifically be looking at today. So The code I'm going to be, you know, demonstrating shortly is shellcode. It's reverse shellcode specifically. Does anybody in this room not know what shellcode is? Don't be embarrassed, because if you don't, I'll just explain quickly. Essentially, shellcode is it effectively gives me a command prompt as if I'm sat on that server, the remote server. Was that mine or yours? Yours, right. This is going to be the server in the test, by the way. And if this was across the other side of the internet, my shell code will give me a shell as if I'm sat at the console here, our Windows NT command prompt. Now, traditional Windows shell code is big. It's about 600 to 700 bytes. And the reason it is that big is because when you're, you know, creating your shell, you go through the create process and you provide pipes as handles, anonymous pipes as handles for standard in, standard out, and standard error. So you can, you know, pass your command to the vulnerable process over TCP. It then uses the pipes to communicate to cmd.exe, and that is passed back out again through these pipes. Now, that unfortunately bloats the code, because we have to do all sorts of things like, you know, creating the pipes, do the Windows socket stuff. That is not necessary whatsoever. By using WSA socket, we can essentially create a socket that is valid as a handle for standard in, standard out, and standard error. So essentially what we can do is create this socket, pass this as the handle for, you know, create process for standard in, standard out, standard error, and then ignore the rest of the process. We don't, you know, the vulnerable process, we can just exit thread from there and let it continue. We don't need to even keep that alive. We can kill it if we want. But CMD is a process in and of its own, you know, writes essentially, and functions perfectly well. So we'll be using WSA socket to do this. So essentially what we need to do is call WSA startup, then WSA socket, bind that socket to the IP address, connect, and then create the process, passing it the handles. Now, if sockets are already loaded into, you know, the address space, i.e., you know, ws2_32.dll and wssoc32.dll are loaded into the address space, we don't actually need to call WSA start, because it's already, you know, been started up. So even if you call WSA startup, you can get, by hard coding addresses, your Windows shell code down to 168 bytes. Now, often traditional Windows shell code is too big to fit into a lot of exploits. You know, you've only got maybe 200 bytes of buffer space to play with. By bringing it down the size below 200 bytes, you know, pretty much every single remote buffer overflow can be, you can use this method for that. Again, removing WSA startup from this, you could probably get it down to maybe 150 bytes, 144 bytes or thereabouts. As it happens, the code published in the end of this book, I think I'm on the last couple of pages. I'm not hard coding addresses because I want my code to be portable. So essentially I'm going through the process of like calling load library, get proc address. So it should work across all platforms and service packs. And indeed, it does. Well, hopefully this is probably the third time about to test it on XP. So it should run anyway. So this is what we're going to do. So in terms of compromising the SQL server, we're going to set netcat listening on our system. Here we have netcat. We've set the port to 80. I'm not sure if the font's too small. I set it as big as I can. Essentially, we're running netcat by NC minus L minus P, and the port we're listening on is 80. As most firewalls will allow 80 out. Cool. Cheers, mate. As most firewalls will allow port 80 out, you know, that we'll give this one a shot first. The command line is the name of the program's SQL UDP. I provide the name of the host, which I'm attacking, Hephaestus in this case. This is the server over here. I supply the IP address of my system where the remote shell, where I want the remote shell to come back to, 10.1.1.27. Specify the port I'm listening on, and the SQL service pack. Now, unfortunately, what the problem here is, I'm using sqlsort.dll, which I thought at first was consistent across all SQL service packs, but unfortunately it's not. The import address entry for get proc address is off by 12 bytes. So the code in your Black Hat manual things is actually wrong. I state in there the SQL sort DLL is consistent. It's not. As I said, there's a difference in the offset of get proc address. So I've updated that code to reflect whether it's service pack 0 or above. Now, let's see. Right, there's my shell just dropped in. This, because I'm running SQL Server's local system, if I do a host name, I can see I'm Hephaestus on this shell, and if I do a host name here, I'm computer name. So we essentially have a remote reverse shell to the SQL Server, and this was unauthenticated. All we did was essentially send 04 as the first byte, buffer, then exploit code. So we have a local system reverse shell. So, and as we can see, we haven't had to go through the rigmarole of, you know, calling create pipe or anything like that. Basically, the handle for standard in, standard out, and standard error is this, you know, the socket itself. So that is that. The code to do this is in the back of the book, as I said. So in terms of firewalls, this is obviously a serious issue.
Who are you when you execute that?
Well, it depends on what the SQL Server is running as. If you've set your SQL Server running as local system, which is not default on SQL Server 2000, by default on SQL Server 2000, you're supposed to specify that a domain user. Okay. There is a checkbox, though, that says use local system. Yeah. So if you're a domain user, if SQL Server is running as a domain user, then you have that domain user's privileges. Now, obviously, because it's a domain user, I can start, if that domain user account hasn't been locked down properly, I can start, you know, using my domain privileges to start accessing other boxes on the network. If it was running as local system, all I would have access to is that host and the data on the database server. That's all. There are advantages to running it as local system. There are advantages to running it as a domain user. It depends on your point of view, and you need to analyze the threat to you. You know, is it going to be too much of a major problem if all of your hosts are compromised? Mind you, there's, as I said, you can lock down using group policies and everything like that, the domain user account, and all it can do is run the SQL services. So I'm not going to suggest you run it as local system. It's definitely a bad thing to do. So looking at firewalls, because this is going over UDP, it's easy to spoof IP addresses over UDP. It's much more difficult with TCP because you have to be able to predict, you know, sequence numbers and so on, and then you have the three-way handshake to go through and everything like that. But with UDP, it's like posting a postcard. You put it in the post and away it goes, as opposed to like dialing a telephone number. And there is no virtual connection that needs to be set up. So it's like fire off your packet and, you know, away you go. We can set the source port, no problems. The code in the back of this sets the port, source port to 53, obviously because most firewalls will allow that through. Spoofing the IP address of someone's external DNS server is definitely going to hit a lot of systems, so it's highly important to disallow any incoming to 1434 from any host, you know, to any of your SQL servers, regardless of what the source port is. If someone, you know, sends out a UDP query with the UDP source port to 1434, tough. You know, just let the firewall still drop it. They'll try and resolve the domain name again and recover it on 1435, so it will increment anyway. So, obviously, there's a patch from Microsoft. If you look at the Microsoft.com site/security. I believe this is covered in the MS Bulletin 02039. Is that 38? Right. Sorry. Thanks. Scott Culp is down here in the corner, and he's informed me it's 38. In fact, 39 also references, I believe, another SQL Server issue. Sure.
Can shell code use UDP?
You can. It's much more difficult, though. I have elected to use TCP here, because I'm lazy, basically. But yes, it can do. In fact, you can actually use Netcat to do this as well. Netcat has this capability. The only quirk with it on Windows is when you type in your command, you have to go D, enter, I, enter, R, enter, you know, enter kind of thing to get it to work. So yes, it can work. A remote shell can work over UDP. Something I should definitely research a bit more, you know, to make it easier. So this has been a fairly brief talk. So I would like to open the, floor to questions kind of thing. Are there any questions? And it doesn't have to be about these issues, any SQL Server issues at all. Sure, go ahead.
The same shellcode that you have you tried that on the buffer overflows with the store procedures?
Yes, I have. Sorry, I'll repeat the questions. The gentleman was asking, have I tried this shellcode on stored procedures? Yes, I have. I've used it against web servers, all sorts of things. Obviously, there's parts of the code that need to be modified to, setting the overwriting the save return address, you know, and so on. But the basic code will work fine. Yeah. Any other? Sure.
In your introduction, they mentioned you were releasing a SQL tool.
Sure. Okay. The question was about the tool I'm about to release. NGS Squirrel essentially is an audit tool for Microsoft SQL servers. It will look for, obviously, all the known vulnerabilities and includes some things that are brand new. It also has exploit capabilities as well, like an exploit wizard. For example, you know, you can tell it to run this command for me, get me sysadmin rights, get me a reverse shell, and so on. So it's a tool designed for, penetration testers, you know, consultancies and so on, to enable them to more easily assess the security of a SQL server. It should be ready, a beta version's ready. Because of its exploit capabilities, I'm not sure what to do in terms of, you know, giving out to the public. I might release a trial version, but cripple the exploit functionality because I don't want too many people coming along and just using it to compromise. I'll probably tie it to localhost as well, but that should be ready in about 1 week to 2 weeks or so on. Any other questions? Sure. Yep, if you go to the ngssoftware.com website, we've just released AuraScan, which is it's in beta at the moment. We're hoping to get the final product ready in about 3 weeks, 3 weeks to a month. AuraScan will assess an Oracle web front end application. It will have minimal Oracle auditing capabilities in there as well, but essentially it's more assessing an Oracle web front end app. Sure. Well, that's a difficult question to answer. Sorry, I'll repeat the question. Which SQL Server has the least vulnerabilities in there at the moment? I would say, and this is only through obscurity, okay, some of the IBM database servers such as DB2 or Infomix, okay, simply because no one's really looked at them yet. DB2 is next on my list. If I can get a copy of Infomix, that will be thereafter. That will be the next one. I believe there was in the password encryption thing with DB2, there was an issue with that, a buffer overflow in the password encryption stuff with DB2. That was released a couple of months back. That's the only thing I know of DB2 that has been announced in the relative past, or the recent past, rather. Oracle definitely has its issues. Microsoft definitely has its issues. MySQL definitely has its issues. I mean, doing a source code review of the Windows port, there was they read a registry key, okay? Now, by default, this registry key doesn't exist, but everybody can create a subkey. So all we needed to do, if we had local access to the box or remote access and using .reg files, we could create this subkey, and if it existed, it would, you know, look it up. So in the process of querying that registry key, there was a buffer overflow. And if it failed in any way in reading that registry key, it would do fprintf, a vulnerable printf statement, you know, a format string bug. Within two lines of code, there was the vulnerable buffer overflow, then a format string bug, within two lines of each other. I was like, you know, I stopped there and then actually. That said, the source code is available with MySQL, so you can take steps to, you know, fix it yourself. I might be incorrect in this, but I don't think... actually, no, I am incorrect in that, so I won't say that. There are a number of databases out there, such as Rubix, again, which hasn't really been looked at much, but doesn't support much in terms of stored procedures or anything like that. You know, simple ANSI SQL, and it's designed to run on trusted operating systems. So I presume that's an extremely strong product. So something like Rubix, if you're interested in strong database products in terms of security, something like Rubix might suit. Although, as I said, I haven't looked at it. This is just from what I can guess, okay? Database security, I think in the next 6 months, is gonna explode in a big way. The hacking community, and I don't necessarily just mean the people breaking into sites and so on like that and defacing, I mean, you know, people doing active research in this area, have known for a long time that you can break into back-end database systems through web servers and so on. I believe this message is beginning to get across to the people using these database servers. And consequently, database security is going to start gaining impetus. People are going to be more concerned with database security. Too many DBAs are worried about performance issues and so on, and security is way down at the bottom of the pile at the moment. I think that needs to change, not just on the DBA's part, but also on the vendor's part as well. More money needs to be spent on securing these issues and less on marketing. So in answer to your question, which is the most secure, I would say, you know, only through obscurity, something like Infomix perhaps, yeah? But then I think even Infomix had a couple of problems with its backdoor, you know, politically incorrect password. Was that Infomix? Did anybody? Which? Interbase, right. Interbase had that backdoor, sorry. Not Infomix. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's safe, though. That's all. Yeah? Sure, at the back? In terms of like appliances, like we've done SQL servers, we've done web servers. No, I can't, unfortunately, at this stage. I mean, LDAP is you know becoming big, okay? Especially with you know Active Directory and so on. So LDAP perhaps is definitely something. If you're interested in doing security research and you're looking for the next big thing, LDAP definitely might worth be looking at, because it seems that everything's going towards the directory structure kind of way. So LDAP, I would probably say. Sure, in the back.
What are your thoughts? You mentioned earlier about the Solaris, Solaris product, Argus, Pitbull, Virtual Vault, HP, Trusted Linux, NSA Linux. How do you see those fitting into these being database servers where you're protecting the OS first so that there's containers?
Well, I'm going to repeat the question because I think I heard it. I'm not sure. In terms of trusted OS, is it like Solaris with Pitbull or you know other operating systems of that level of assurance? Do I see them being used more often in terms of you know as being set up as database servers? Was that the question? Yes, for certain establishments. No, for others. Running a CMW-based system, something like Virtual Vault or Solaris with Pitbull, is a difficult task and an expensive proposition. Something like the Microsoft solution, it's great, it's functional, it's got good performance, it's fairly scalable, and it's cheap and works out the box, okay? Security issues aside. So a lot of people in the commercial sector will be looking for that kind of product. People in the military, government organizations and so on, will probably be looking at, you know, trusted operating systems and trusted database servers on top of that. Because obviously the value of the data, when it has national importance, national security importance, is obviously, you know, you need that kind of proof, you know, or security blanket to say, yes, we think we're pretty goddamn secure.
What about adding to that reverse proxy capability?
I'm sorry? So in terms of like almost like an application firewall in front of it, Tim Mullen and I, Tim is actually speaking next door, which is unfortunate because it would have been good to see his talk on NIMDA and AttackBack. Tim and I were actually speaking about doing an application proxy. For SQL Server, Microsoft SQL Server, it's a very, very difficult proposition. And the reason why is, say you are looking for XP underscore CMD shell, and your firewall, essentially, your application firewall, will look for that string. There are 65,000 million ways I can encode XP underscore CMD shell to bypass your, you know, your firewall. For example, I could go declare at foo nvarchar 300, select at foo equals ox, and then the hex string for XP underscore CMD shell, okay? And then exec bracket at foo or whatever kind of thing, yeah? Now, I have essentially encoded my attack in a different way than how you're looking for it. But sure, you can then, you know, cause your, you know, add a rule into your application proxy, firewall rather, to look for that specific string. But then you have to do the non-Unicode version. You have to do the Unicode version. I could XOR it, you know, using Transact SQL. I could XOR, you know, my string with 5.9, OX5.9 before, you know, putting it through and then un-XOR it with 5.9 again before I do the exact. There is just so many ways. Because it's TSQL, it's essentially a programming language in itself. You know, for every way you can think of a defense, someone else will be able to think of 100 ways to bypass that defense. So it's a difficult proposition. It's not impossible. And let's face it, you will stop 99% of the attacks. And that's a good thing. But you have to be aware that there will always be an attack that gets through. And it's those kind of attacks that are launched by the intent cracker who is really, you know, he's not going to deface your website. He's going to steal your data and do something nefarious with it, like sell it to your competitor or something. And it's these kind of attackers, these kind of attackers will simply bypass, you know, any firewall you put in front or any application proxy you put in front, kind of. So, as I said, if your database server though is like Rubix, which only supports like supports ANSI SQL 92 and a bit of 99, then sure you can start, you know, limiting what can be done. But if it supports any kind of scripting language like TSQL, no, you're in for a rough ride. Sure.
Given your experience with Oracle, do you have any comment or thoughts on their Unbreakable campaigning?
I think, right. I think their campaign was clever. Now, by saying it's unbreakable, they actually were meaning your business is unbreakable. You know, as close to 100% uptime as you can possibly get. Sorry, I'll repeat the question just in case I've been asked to repeat the questions. He's asked for my comments on the Oracle Unbreakable campaign. And as I said, it's a clever thing. Now, they're not just talking about the software's unbreakable, because that's obviously not true. They're talking about your business will become unbreakable. Unfortunately, there was a sort of like small print tagline, can't break it, can't break in, which sort of destroys that. But essentially what they got was free press. You know, when we released these holes in Oracle, Oracle was in, you know, the papers. Now, I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, you know, something like free press, or any press is good press, you know. So they got free press out of it. They have, you know, hours and hours of free security work done on it, you know. If they had paid me to do that, you know, review, it would have cost them an arm and a leg, but they got it done for free. So there are certain advantages to that marketing campaign. I believe the security guys at Oracle were like, no, you can't do this. But marketing and security are two entirely different, you know, divisions. So there were benefits to their marketing campaign. Yes? Sure. Sorry, is anybody doing security research on? I don't know if anybody's doing security research on it. It's on my list to do. Unfortunately, my list to do is like this big at the moment. But if no one else is, then wait a couple of months and hopefully we'll have something for you. You know, that's all I can say at this stage. Sure.
Other than such a strong SAP patch, is there like configuration changes that would stop messy attacks?
Yes. The public role has too much freedom. The public role essentially is, sorry, I keep on forgetting to repeat the question. Is there anything we can do to mitigate these attacks? And yes, there is, and it's limiting what public can do. Now, for example, there are certain extended store procedures we can call that allow us to gain the privileges of the SQL Server. Okay. Now, if I drop public permissions on those extended store procedures, then no one can use that as an attack. And it's just a simple configuration change. So I would look carefully at your database server and see what public can do and ask yourself questions such as, what can they do with this, you know, particular bit of functionality? Do I want them to be able to do that? And if you don't, remove public, you know, from it. Also, remove guest access from the MSDB database. MSDB has a number of stored procedures that people forget about because they think stored procedures are all in the master database. MSDB has a lot of stored procedures that are crucial to the way replication and the SQL agent and everything like that operates. So take a look at that and, you know, remove guest access and remove public from those stored procedures. So yes, you can lock down the SQL Server. There are certain things, certain vulnerabilities that you can't do anything about, such as the PWD encrypt buffer overflow. There's nothing you can do about that. Everybody needs to be able to access that, essentially, if you want to, if you want them to change their passwords. And it's a function it's quite difficult to, you know, to protect against, because it's all internal. Things like open row set abuse, you can disallow ad hoc queries by, you know, setting things in the registry. I can't remember the registry key off the top of my head, but do a search on under ad hoc access, and that will supply the registry key for you.
Is it allow ad hoc queries?
Right, I think it's, well, as Scott says, it's allow ad hoc queries. Set it to zero, I presume, to disallow them, set them to one. Now, the thing is with they're under the provider's key, essentially. Now, the ADSQL one has this key in there already, and it's set to zero. Unfortunately, the SQL OLEDB provider does not. None of the other providers do. So a member of public can call these procedures, these functions like OpenRowSet and OpenDataSource, and run ad hoc queries using different libraries, different providers. So you need to actually physically go in there and change, you know, add these values for these specific providers. Only, as I said, the MSADSQL one has it. Sure.
It is possible to run a SQL Server as an ordinary user on the box. It doesn't necessarily have to be a privileged user in all cases.
Correct.
I don't know the ins and outs of, you know, exactly when you can and cannot get away with it, but it's something to investigate because, you know, that way an attack may give up the database.
Sure, but it depends on what your objective is as an attacker. I mean, if I'm after your data, and let's face it, that's where the goodies are, you know, then I don't care about compromising your host. I'm after the data, you know?
Absolutely, but if you're after the service password stashed in the LSA,
sure,
then it's much more convenient to be administrator.
Right. When I'm doing penetration tests for the for organizations, you know, like companies, I say, here's your administrator password. They go, I say, well, here's your customer database. I go, oh my fucking God, you know, like, so it's.
Yeah, I wonder where aware of that. Yes.
But you're right, absolutely. It can be a low-privilege user. Chip Andrews, I think, has done some good research on, and again, if you go to sqlsecurity.com, he's done some research on, you know, what privileges this user actually needs and what it doesn't need. So definitely take a look at sqlsecurity.com. Sorry, over there?
Are you still looking at Domino, and have you looked at the beta R6? It's about to be coming out.
I did take a look at it just to see whether, you know, it allowed me to enumerate the database structures like, you know, version 5 did. And the beta I looked at, and this was going back about 3 months ago, did not allow me to enumerate the database structures in the same fashion I did with, you know, previous versions of Domino Web Server. That may, you know, that functionality, well, that feature may be back in there. I don't know. It's something I'm going to have to do again. As I said, it's on my to-do list.
That was a very good paper, and I appreciate you documenting the doc ID creation stuff. Lotus has not done a very good job of that. That's been very helpful in proving that it's not a real good idea to just assume that people aren't going to figure that out.
Sure. Thank you for your praise. Sure.
How much time did it take you to find these vulnerabilities?
5 minutes. Literally 5 minutes. As soon as I saw SQL ping, and was sniffing the traffic, I saw it was 0.02 byte was the byte. I said, well, what does all the other ones do? And literally, by, as I said, it was dead by 8. You know, that was like a nanosecond. And then it was just like, well, start disassembling and putting the NT-regimon. And literally within 5 minutes, you know, I think the mails were actually sent to Microsoft at the time. You know, it was like, found a heap overflow. Then a couple of seconds later, there was like, sent them another mail. Oh, now a Stack Overflow, you know? It was literally like that, within 5 minutes.
And how long can you estimate it to take from finding a vulnerability to reaching exploit capability?
Well, it depends. If you've got code, you know, you can just cut and paste in. It can be a few more minutes more. With this one, it took me about an hour to, you know, do all the assembly and everything like that. So from discovering the vulnerability to exploiting the, or having working exploit code, you know, 1 to 2 hours, essentially. It can be shorter than that. As I said, if you've already got pre-code that you can just cut and paste in, you know, so. Sure. I'm sorry? Did I do research on? Oh, right, sorry, yeah. The only other interesting one after that is 0A, you know, like a new line character. And that's where the, you know, servers start pinging each other to death. And anything above that is pretty much irrelevant. If you... there's a bit of... it's on my other laptop, I'm sorry. There's I've broken it down, essentially, that you can look at the assembly for it. There's a couple of jump instructions, you know, if above 6, go here, if, you know, do this, if not, blah, 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 blah. And pretty much everything above 0A is useless. So that's, there's only a couple of ones that do anything interesting, and everything after 0A is nothing. Any other questions? Sure.
I read an article saying that you were going to start releasing publicly a little faster than you have been.
Yep.
First of all, is that to suggest that Microsoft has been slow in their responses to the vulnerabilities you address?
No. What it suggests is we're unhappy with certain vulnerabilities being rolled up in service packs. We believe they deserve more attention and have a hotfix be provided for them. Now, what you're speaking about specifically is the vendor notification alerts, okay? This wasn't just Microsoft doing this. This was iPlanet. I found a buffer overflow in the search capabilities in iPlanet, and they said, we're going to service pack this. And I was like, this is a remotely exploitable buffer overflow on, you know, Solaris, NT, blah, 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 you know, and you're going to put this in a service pack. That's crazy, in my opinion. So in an attempt to persuade vendors, and that's all you can ever do is attempt to persuade them, to start taking things more seriously and produce hotfixes for them, I thought it would be good if we announced to the public in a limited capacity that there is an issue here, And that way, the customers of that vendor would turn around and say, look, I know there's a hole. I don't know where the hole is. I'm just told there is a hole. Where's the patch for it? Yeah. So I'm not sure whether, you know, it's working. Only time will tell. But it's not about the speed of them getting a patch out. It's to make sure they get a patch out. Yeah. It's very important, and this was Scott Culp and I had a good discussion about this, and a number of things that I had neglected to think about were pointed out to me. And one of them is there are so many patches these days that a number of people become shy about applying patches, especially if they break, you know, something. Now, if a vendor rushes a patch and you apply that patch and it breaks some other area of functionality, you're going to go, bloody hell, I'm not applying any more patches. Yeah. Now, it's important for the vendor to ensure that the patch works 100% when it goes live. And if it takes them 2 months to ensure that that happens, so be it. You know, as I said, it's not so much to, you know, speed them up. It's to make sure patches are provided to their customers, as opposed to leaving them vulnerable for 6 months, you know, to a year, whilst a service pack is waiting to come out. I believe Service Pack 3 came out today. Is that? Yeah, Service Pack 3 came out today. If you didn't hear, and there are a number of issues in there that have been outstanding since September last year. And personally, I think some of these issues should have had a hotfix produced for them. But that's my opinion. Obviously, the vendor has their own opinion as well. Right. Okay. I'm going to wrap up here. And thank you all very much for coming.